The snowy mountains of the Andes figure in a new documentary film, Stranded. I've Come From a Plane That Crashed on the Mountains has an amazing story to go along with its long title. Los Angeles Times and Morning Edition film critic Kenneth Turan has this review.
Stranded is an exceptional film. It tells one of the 20th century's best-known tales of survival and shows that we haven't really known it at all. Who hasn't heard the story of the Uruguayan airliner that slammed into the Andes in 1972? Who doesn't know about the 16 young men who survived for 72 days because they did the unthinkable and ate the flesh of those who died? Their story, under the title Alive, became both an internationally best-selling book and a Hollywood movie starring Ethan Hawke.
And when she's dead, I'm gonna climb out of these goddamn mountains. Back to my father, back to my room and my house.
Are you gonna do that? Freeze to death.
Not if I wore enough clothes, I wouldn't. You'd starve to death.
Nando, you can't climb a mountain on a little piece of chocolate and a sip of wine.
Well, then I'll cut some meat off the pilots.
But it is only now, some 35 years after the fact, that the people who made it out alive agreed to talk on camera with breathtaking candor about what they went through. These stories do not shortchange the horror of the situation, but out of disaster can come the purity of transcendence. The survivor's experience turns out to have been a surprisingly spiritual one, a story of near reincarnation and intimate religious communion. One reason these men felt safe unburdening themselves was that the director, Gonzalo Arijon, was also a boyhood friend. He has added several things to the compelling interviews, including a delicate score and haunting, dreamlike recreations that heightened the drama. Roberto Canessa, one of the two men who walked out of the Andes to save the group, was at Stranded Sundance premiere, and it's no exaggeration to say that what he experienced turned him into a figure of enormous charisma. Asked to reflect on it all, he replied quietly, "Make plans for 100 years, but you must be ready to die at any moment." Words to live by, and a film impossible to forget.
The movie is Stranded. Kenneth Turan reviews movies for Morning Edition and the Los Angeles Times, and you can see clips from Stranded and find more reviews of this week's new movies at NPR.org.
This is All Things Considered from NPR News. I'm Michelle Norris.
And I'm Robert Siegel. Now that the election is over, Americans can return to one of our great obsessions, picking over the minutiae of celebrities' lives, if indeed anyone ever stopped doing that. Every Monday night at a small cabaret that is packed on Manhattan's Upper West Side, real celebrities put on a show called Celebrity Autobiography in their own words. Jeff London took in one of the shows.
The idea is simplicity itself. Have a really good comic actor read from a celebrity autobiography for fun and laughs, like Kristen Johnston of Third Rock from the Sun.
Hello, everyone. I will be reading from Mr. T, The Man with the Gold, an autobiography by Mr. T. Here is the unadulterated truth, told, written, and spoken in such terms that even a fool can understand what I'm talking about.
Celebrity Autobiography is the brainchild of comedy writer and actor Eugene Pack, who's something of a connoisseur of these often remaindered books. He thought the grandiosity and banality of some of them would make for a comic evening, so he invited some friends to try it out in Los Angeles.
Instantly, it seemed to work on stage, bringing these words to life, these oddball passages, and it's just taken off and really caught on with audiences.
After a long run in L.A., Pack brought the show to New York, where a rotating cast of actors, ranging from Matthew Broderick to Andrea Martin to Paul Rudd, take the stage to deliver excerpts from books by pop icons, large and small. Saturday Night Live's Will Forte says he tries to show up whenever he has a free Monday evening.
It's such a fun show to do because you don't have to memorize anything. You're up there for a pretty short amount of time, and then you just get to enjoy all these other great people. It's always a really fun collection of people.
The Dirt by Motley Crue. And this section was written by Tommy Lee. The chick was Heather Locklear, and the guy who introduced us was my accountant, Chuck Shapiro. He knew Heather because his brother was her dentist.
It's the meticulous recounting of details that most of us ignore in our own lives that make for some of the funniest moments in the show. Former Saturday Night Live cast member Rachel Dratch is a frequent performer. One of her favorite passages comes from Good Morning, I'm Joan London.
I kind of figure that, like, maybe somebody told her to just write down every single thing that happens to her in the morning. Don't leave anything out. So she, you know, bothers to tell you that she tears a little semicircle in the lid of her coffee cup to keep from spilling it on herself.
I always lay out the clothes I'm going to wear into the studio the night before. These are casual clothes, not those I'll wear on the air. I stack them in the order that I put them on. That is, panties on top, then bra, skirt or pants, some kind of casual shirt or sweater, socks and shoes. Outside, the limousine is waiting.
While they mine the stories of celebrities for laughs, Eugene Pack and Will Forte insist...
It's all done with love, though.
The whole thing is done with affection and just fun and love. It's not... None of it is meant to be negative or mean. I mean, that's why people have a great time. It's just fun.
Still, after performing for several months in Celebrity Autobiography, Will Forte and Rachel Dratch say they're not tempted to write their own.
I don't know that I felt the need to do an autobiography.
I prefer reading people's autobiographies to writing my own.
That's good.
Much, much less work.
Celebrity Autobiography, in their own words, is playing an open-ended run at the Triad Theater in Manhattan on Monday evenings. For NPR News, I'm Jeff London in New York.
And you can hear more performances from Celebrity Autobiography, in their own words, at npr.org.
The Rocky Horror Picture Show is the ultimate cult movie. It bombed at the box office when it came out in 1975, but a fan base quickly developed around its campy music and its characters. In some places, even today, you can go and see the Rocky Horror Picture Show every weekend, if that's your kind of thing. Now, another movie is vying to become the next cult classic, as Beth Accomando of member station KPBS reports.
When Darren Lynn Bousman decided to make Repo the genetic opera, he sensed the cult potential in its distinctive retro-future goth story.
In the future, people can buy and sell organs on credit. And if you buy a heart, you can buy a heart. However, if you miss a payment and you're not able to afford that heart, it is complete responsibility of the provider to repossess that organ.
Say that you once bought a heart or new corneas, but somehow never managed to square away your debts. He won't bother to write or to phone you. He'll just rip the still-beating heart from your chest.
Bousman wanted to tap into an underserved audience, just as Rocky Horror Picture Show had done three decades ago.
They are what I was when I was growing up in high school, the outcast, the freaks, the alternative, the fringe. And that's a huge, huge, huge market.
But engineering a cult hit is difficult to do. David Glanzer is marketing director for Comic-Con International, where many films have tried to assert their cult worthiness. But Glanzer says, if you look at the Rocky Horror Picture Show, it initially failed at the box office. And then fans turned it into a cult phenomenon.
It was so far out there that it was cool to be associated with that. Can you go in there with the intention of creating what's cool? That's a tough one.
But it's a very different environment now than it was in 1975 when the Rocky Horror Picture Show came out. Now, the internet provides a powerful but still unpredictable marketing tool for filmmakers. Bousman has embraced the internet because it costs him nothing but his time.
Every single night, myself and the creators are on the website in the chat rooms talking to the fans, planning little stunts, you know, figuring out what we can do as a grassroots effort to get the movie out there. And so I think the fans feel a part of something, because think about it, you're talking to the director, the lead actor, and the composer of the movie on a nightly basis on this website, saying, okay, everyone print out 10 flyers and go to 10 different locations and convert 10 strangers.
Beyond building a fan base, Bousman says you need three things to make a cult film, beginning with a sense of camp.
And I think that, you know, that helps with any cult film, is that you have to be able to know it's okay to make fun of yourselves. And we make fun of ourselves in Repo. And I think that number one. Number two is, I think that we haven't commercialized the movie. And I think that's the other thing for a cult. You can't commercialize the movie. And number three, I mean, I think the other thing is just the casting of the movie. The casting is just so weird and out there, and again, non-commercial, that I think that helps it.
The diverse cast of Repo features Alexa Vega from Spy Kids, Broadway star Sarah Brightman, award-winning actor Paul Sorvino, Anthony Stewart Head from Buffy the Vampire Slayer, and Paris Hilton. But what ultimately makes or breaks a cult film is fans, ravenous, devoted fans.
If you go to see Rocky Horror Picture Show at midnight on Saturday night, you're not watching a movie, you're watching an event. And you show up there and people are dressed in outfits, and you've all this diverse group of people in a theater having fun. And there is a sense of community around the showing.
Bousman hopes to be building that community as Repo: The Genetic Opera opens this weekend. For NPR News, this is Beth Accomando. I can't feel nothing at all.
Tomorrow, the Supreme Court will hear arguments about a word that we cannot utter on this program. The case stems from some stunning moments of live television. For example, the 2002 Billboard Music Awards, televised by Fox, when Cher accepted a Lifetime Achievement Award and was less than magnanimous in victory.
I've also had critics for the last 40 years saying that I was on my way out every year. Right. So, f*** them.
Well, Cher's utterance of the F word is one of several instances of indecent language on television that the Supreme Court will address in the case FCC versus Fox TV. The main questions at issue appear to be these. Can the FCC penalize broadcasters in some instances for indecent language but not in others? And is it different when the aforementioned unmentionable F word is used in a single, fleeting kind of way as opposed to a repetitive, unrelenting George Carlin kind of way? But there's also a subsidiary argument that we're going to explore for a moment. Appellate judges were divided as to whether the F word is invariably an allusion to sexual congress, or is it sometimes just an expletive unhinged from its actual meaning? Well, just the question of the meaning of this word led us to Jesse Scheidlauer, who is editor-at-large for the Oxford English Dictionary and author of a book called The F Word. Welcome to the program.
Thank you. Good to be here.
And to avoid repetition and to avoid promoting the title of your book at every turn, instead of saying the F word, let's have another F word, floss. Let's say the word we're talking about is floss, okay?
Okay.
Okay. First of all, how old a word is this word, floss?
The earliest evidence for it is in the late 15th century. And in this example, it is in a manuscript where it is a text in both Latin and English. And the English words are, you know, including the equivalent of floss, are actually written in a cipher where it's replaced with different letters of the alphabet, which suggests that even then it was something that was considered taboo.
Well, at what point does floss cease to just mean what it literally meant and take on the life of an independent epithet?
Well, it's hard to tell exactly, but most of the figurative senses are comparatively recent. There is one example or two examples from the 18th century of this word being used meaning something like to harm or to victimize, but quite rare then. So all the evidence we have suggests that the very large number of examples, when people say, well, this is used in every part of speech, in every compounds, in every blah, 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 these are examples from this century mostly, from the 20th century.
From the past century,
yes.
as we now say.
Yes.
But before that, I mean, before those days, a word describing a sex act wouldn't logically be the worst thing you could say to somebody, or the most offensive thing you could invoke.
Well, there are a number of different kinds of words that have been considered offensive at different times. Words insulting one's parentage, so words like bastard or whore son, were once considered extremely offensive. And if they were written in print at all, they would be written with dashes, you know, B-D for bastard, let's say, the same way that the F word or the S word might be written now in some places. And more recently, the racial or ethnic epithets have become the most offensive things we have. I mean, that would be a career ender for any politician who used it in some sort of, you know, honest way.
Well, looking back then on the reign of the F word, reign of floss as the worst thing one could possibly say, pretty long given the history of the English language?
I think the important thing here is to look at the context. For most of the history of this word, it has been in use in sexual senses. And what has changed is not, it's several things. It's partly that we are less squeamish about sex, but it's also that the word has ceased being used exclusively in reference to sex. In fact, the overwhelming majority of uses of it now are not in reference to sex.
Yeah, Cher was not. We don't think Cher was suggesting that someone should have sexual intercourse with her critics at that moment.
No, and neither was the vice president suggesting that Senator Leahy should perform an anatomically difficult act when he used this word on the floor of the Senate. So, there are all sorts of examples of this word that are not sexual, and shouldn't be taken that way.
And yet, the word remains very much out of bounds in many contexts, certainly including, say, primary and secondary education. It's hard to imagine a classroom where people would freely use the word without some penalty for doing
well,
so.
Well, no, but that's true of many things. I mean, there are all sorts of places where certain words are considered okay and certain words are considered not okay. And people are, I think, correct to be upset in some cases but not in others. I was reading this morning, there was an article in the Philadelphia Inquirer about the World Series where one of the players used this word on camera and in front of the radios. He said world flossing champions, as it were, and the paper reported the crowd loved it, erupting into cheers for several minutes. And the reporter
went
on. We're
talking about Philadelphia.
In Philadelphia, yes. The TV and radio stations were extremely upset, but the reporter talked to a number of people who were in the audience, people with children, who said, well, it's really not such a big deal, and he was excited, and I don't really care. So clearly the only people who are really being upset by this are people who are worried that the government is going to crack down on them, not people who are upset because the word itself was used.
Not such a big flossing deal, you're saying, in that
right.
case. Mr. Scheidlauer, thank you very much for talking with us.
Oh, thank you for having me.
Jesse Scheidlauer, who is editor-at-large for the Oxford English Dictionary and author of the book called The F-Word, and we used the word floss as a substitute for the subject of Mr. Scheidlauer's book.